And hello out there to all you Metsian folk. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here on the Metsian Podcast, and we are so thankful that you are here. If this is your first time listening to us, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and let us know if there is somewhere that we are not, and we need to place ourselves there. So thank you. We have a lot to get to, so without further ado, before we bring on our featured guests, which we're so – it's so wonderful to have him on this week, let me go around the room and first start in Brooklyn with Mike Licola. What's going on, Mike? Oh, Mike, queuing up.
Sorry about that. Ka-ching, dollar in the jar. Hello, Sam. Hello, everyone. Hello, Metsville. Very excited to get tonight's show underway.
Very excited indeed, and let's head up the turnpike up to 95 and all those highways around here in the tri-state to Connecticut with Rich Virago. What's going on, Rich?
I'm doing well tonight, Sam. Hope you are doing the same, and very much looking forward to a special edition of the podcast.
Yes, myself as well, and without further ado, let us get to – I'm not sure where on the highway – we are going to go to the Metsian roots of this gentleman who is a film director. He is a producer. He has his own production company, and he has made a documentary for All Time with Once Upon a Time in Queens, capturing an all-time team in the 1986 New York Mets, and that is Nick Davis. Nick, thank you so much for joining the Metsian Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, guys.
So let's get right to it. I do want to talk about – I know you have a lot to talk about with the 2021 Mets as well as the 1986 Mets. But first, you know, let's just cue it up. I'm curious where on the highway we go. What are your Metsian roots, Nick?
My Metsian roots are – my first memory is an imagined memory. It's a fake screen memory of watching the Mets win the World Series in 1969 when I am 4 years old and I'm watching on the Zenith, which is covered by, you know, wallpaper in our living room in the village in Manhattan. And the truth is, I know that's a fake memory. I know it's not real. But somehow when I was a little kid, I concocted this memory because what I was living with is, you know, the 1970, 71, 72 Mets who were not winning. And that became the goal. Like, okay, well, someday I'm gonna have an actually winning team. And then we got close in 73. And, you know, but really for me, my childhood ended on June 15th, 1977, when they traded Seaver. And Seaver, you know, the importance of Seaver to the franchise just cannot be overstated. And it was such a punch to the grill, as Chuck D says in the film. It was just like, wait, what? And then, you know, the Mets fell into utter disrepair. And, you know, the Mets had been bad before, someone in the film says, but never boring. And then all of a sudden the Mets were irrelevant. And it was just like, it was just awful. So those are my Metsian roots. You know, I came by it the hard way. And all that time, you know, I was a huge baseball fan, and I was a fan of great legendary teams, and I knew the 75 Reds were amazing. And I read about the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers and the Boys of Summer, and I hated them, but I knew the 77, 78 Yankees were legendary. And I just was like, well, why can't we get one of those? And so when that began to happen, and it happened really, you know, as soon as Doubleday bought the team in 1980, he hires Frank Cashin, and you just start to feel like, whoa, wait a minute, something's happening here. And then they draft this guy, you know, who's supposed to be the Black Ted Williams with the incredible name of Daryl Strawberry. And you just start to feel like, well, maybe this is actually really going to happen. So anyway, that's going on at some length about my my Metsian roots. but there you go.
And no, it's beautiful. And so, you know, I'm a filmmaker myself, so it's really interesting to talk to you. And I don't want to, like, go down too much of a like a a theory tangent on this podcast, but I want to start in terms of the broad introductory thesis. I'm wondering, is this the most personal film that you've ever made?
What a interesting question. I think ultimately it is, and I've been surprised by that because I didn't think it was a personal film. I thought it was a film about the Mets, and I had to sort of separate the Mets fan from the filmmaker and make sure I was telling the story, you know, not just to people who knew it, not just to Mets fans, but to everybody. But I do think there's something about, I mean, it's so much my dream project, and it's so much something that I have on some level wanted to do since, well, August of 85 is when I really, I remember being at a game in August of 85, and it was, Gooden was pitching, and the place was rocking and going crazy, and I said to myself, remember this, it's not going to happen again, it's never going to be like this again. And, you know, we didn't win in 85, and it was disappointing, but it still felt like, yeah, but this was legendary. It was epic. That three-game series against the Cardinals in St. Louis was just classic. And I knew it was, like, historical. And so I guess yes, it is. It is the most personal film I've made.
So how has it been, working with 30 for 30? It seems like it's such a great platform for exposure.
Yeah, they were great. I mean, what's great about them is there's no house style, you know. They're very filmmaker friendly, and they, you know, trusted me and trusted the process and trusted our team and the way we went about things, and, you know, gave good notes, but weren't insistent on anything, and they were, you know, a tremendous partner all the way along. Really, really terrific. I can't say enough about them. And it goes back to even before we started the project. You know, my last film was a film about Ted Williams, and for American Masters, the PBS series, which is also a fantastic strand, and they'd never done a baseball film before. So it was really fantastic that I got to do it. It was really fun. And while I was working on that, because that was also with Major League Baseball, I talked to the Major League Baseball folks and said, like, why hasn't the 86 Mets ever been done in full? Yes, they did Doc and Darryl, and parts of the story have been told. But the complete story, this epic tale of a team and a time and a place, that had never been told in a long-form documentary. And this is the era of the long-form documentary. And the Mets said, well, let's get through – I mean, the MLB said, let's get through, you know, Ted Williams, and then we'll talk. And we had a good experience, and so we wanted to keep going and partner. And so in the summer of 2018, I had a meeting, and Sam, you may know this word. I had a general at ESPN. I wasn't really there to pitch anything. And I had a meeting with this executive named Adam Newhouse, and it was the day Ted Williams aired. And he said, so what are you going to do next? And I said, well – why has no one ever done the full 86 Mets story? And he said, oh, we get pitched that all the time. And, you know, it's a real problem because, you know, you got to get the Mets. And he gave me this whole laundry list of things to do in order to make it happen. And I sort of walked into that. But he was encouraging. I mean, he wasn't scoffing at me because, and he agreed, it's a terrific story. But he just said, you know, that's a tough one to wrangle for a lot of different reasons. Anyway, long story short, you know, one of the things he said was, you know, no offense, Nick, but you're going to need an 800-pound gorilla to really sell this thing. So you need the Mets, you need Major League Baseball, you need a real pitch, and you need a written document that details how you're going to do this, and you need the 800-pound gorilla. So a little over a year later, I walk in there with, you know, the Mets, Major League Baseball, a pitch, a great pitch document, and Jimmy Kimmel as the executive producer, and we have a terrific meeting, yeah. And as I'm walking out of the room, Adam Newhouse says, nobody ever listened to me before. And so, you know, they from that moment on, actually, we ended up having a little bidding war, but when we went to ESPN, they just got it instantly, what we were trying to do. And Adam, I think, got it in the summer of 2018. He just wasn't sure that we'd be able to pull it off, and we did.
there's so many more questions regarding pulling it off. And what I'd basically, this is the outline for what I'd like to do. I'd like to pass it to my fellow compadres here on the podcast, Rich Sparago and Michael Collant, and then like to talk about the 2021 Mets, the 1986 Mets, and your film. And so first I'm going to pass it to Rich Sparago for his first question.
Hi, Nick. And, you know, what struck me, and I'd like to tail off of what you just said about, you know, the 800-pound gorilla telling the whole story of the 86 Mets. So what struck me about the documentary is the way you wrapped it in context. And what I mean by that is a lot of the first episode, like we talked about before we went on air, talks about setting the stage of what was really going on, because, you know, people know about the 86 Mets and they, you know, rose like a phoenix from the ashes of the, you know, 82, 83 and all that. But understanding how they got there, you know, thinking about 1977, which people might say, well, why are you talking about 1977 in a documentary about the 86 Mets? But what a tumultuous year that was. You know, everything going on in New York between David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, the Seaver trade, the fact that the Yankees won the World Series, all of that. So my question is, when you decided you wanted to tell this story, how did you get to the point where, that I appreciate so much, around wrapping it in the context of the 8 years or the 9 years prior to really build the viewer up to what an achievement this was, and how not only did the Mets come out of it, but the way you talked about it in the film, that New York City was revived in the early 80s. So how did, what gave you that great idea to wrap it in that context?
I think that this goes back to the first question. I think it was my personal experience, probably, because I had experienced, oh my God, we've been punched in the gut. The city is in the toilet. Ford to City, drop dead. Son of Sam, nobody wants to live here. And now the team, our beloved New York Mets, are in the toilet. And how are we going to get out of this? And that's a great place to start a movie. You know, that's you got nowhere to go but up. So it felt like a natural starting point for the film, because it was the natural starting point when I would think about where the 86 Mets began. I don't think, you know, I'm not saying you couldn't tell the story in 100 different ways, but to me, without the Seaver trade, there is no 86 Mets. So that's where it seemed right to begin there to me. And I was nervous about it. I was very nervous about it, because I think people, you know, hear 1986 Mets and you think, oh, great, let's go, 86. Oh, it's so wild and crazy. And it's like, yeah, but you got to get there, and you have to understand the context, and it'll mean more if you know the characters, not just the characters of Daryl Strawberry and Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter and Dwight Gooden, but the character of the city. And if you know where the city has come from, I think that the payoff of 86, the domination of 86, will be that much more understandable and enjoyable and fun and compelling and all those things you want out of a movie.
Absolutely. And I so appreciated that. And I guess one final question from my perspective before I turn over to Mike. The opening of episode one, the angle you shot where seemingly behind first base, maybe fighting on the first baseline, of what went on in the field, I've never seen that angle before. I was fortunate enough, I was at that game. And obviously I'll never forget game 7 of the 86 World Series, of course. But the angle you shot, just my jaw dropped. Watch, because it was so genuine. It was so, I felt like I was back there in the moment. Can I ask, how did you get that shot? Where'd you get that from?
That shot was from Major League Baseball. And they had, you know, there's this great, as I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners know, you know, there's this amazing year-end video that they did that year called A Year to Remember. And for that, they had hired, Major League Baseball had hired a documentary film crew that was filming intermittently during the course of the season, and we got to use all of their footage, and then had an extra, I think, two cameras, one on either side,
during the playoffs and World Series games at Shea. And so that shot, I don't even think they used very much of it in A Year to Remember. And when we got it and watched it, it just felt like, well, this gets you there. This takes you there. Not just in a totally new way, because we're all familiar with the TV angle and you know, Vin Scully's, you know, call, but like you're there, like you're really there. And then the cameraman rushes the field and he runs by a cop and you see everyone, you know, crowding, you know, Knight jumping on home plate and everybody jumping on him, and you never see Buckner, and you're watching Mookie, and then everything goes crazy. And it just felt like, well, that's, you know, that's an exciting, you know, way to start the series. And then, you know, it's like, well, how did we get here? Let's kick it back with a flashback.
Amazing. Thank you for that. I'll let Mike take over. Thank you, Nick.
Sure.
Well, in lieu of a question, Nick, I would like to say thank you. You dotted a lot of I's and crossed a lot of T's for me. And you brought me closer to the 1986 Mets than I've ever been without being here in person to experience it. I was in Germany at the time. And, you know, as Once Upon a Time in Queens came on TV, I told my son, watch this. He's a Yankee fan, but he was going to watch it anyway. I said, watch this and learn what it was like to be 10 to 19 years old in New York City. And you captured everything marvelously. My sister's 8 years older than I, and we were nervous because of David Berkowitz, Son of Sam. And, you know, you captured the blackout and everything that New Yorkers endured throughout that time in the 70s and early 80s. And again, I was in Germany, and, you know, I was one of the 8 to 13,000 people at Shea Stadium, and it was so cavernous in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, you come to 1985 and 86, you couldn't pack another body into there. So I have to say thank you for bringing me as close to that team and that experience as I've ever been. Again, not being here to experience it in person. I was in Germany. I was in the forests of northern West Germany at the time on military maneuvers. And I was relying on the Stars and Stripes newspaper and Armed Forces Network to provide me updates, you know, and I'd get them anywhere from 12 to 36 hours late. And that's the way I experienced the latter part of the 1986 season. I was able to see, you know, the opening of the season and right up until the end of June, bits and pieces of July. And I managed to see, I believe it was bits and parts of Game 3 at Boston, but certainly not the whole thing, because I was in and out of a recreation center that they have on our training facilities, and that was it for me. And here I am, 54, a native New Yorker, and I am still yet, as you were in 1969, you know, that shadow of 1973 was just that for me. And here I am, 54 years old, and I am still yet to experience a New York Mets World Series here in New York
City.
So well, I just want to say thank you.
Well, you're very, very welcome. And I do – I don't know if you guys want to go to 2021. I am very optimistic about the franchise right now. So I do think we're going to get one, and I think we're going to get one pretty soon. But, you know, that's maybe just the absurd, you know, the delusions of a Mets fan. But anyway, thank you. You know, I did want to say I feel like the feeling of in the city in the 70s and 80s is something that I think we, you know, those of us at a certain age sort of forget. Like that not everybody remembers it, and not everybody can understand. Like, it was a very different place. It was really gritty and grimy. And even in the 80s, when there was sort of like the Sheen and MTV, and it was cleaned up, but it was still gritty and dirty and real and kind of dangerous. And that feeling, I think, was really captured in that side angle shot that you guys were asking about. And then it's one of the reasons why I just thought, well, this is you know, good place as any to start the story.
I can't
well,
reiterate
I also,
enough.
Sorry, Mike.
I'm sorry, Sam. I just wanted to say I was bereft of a lot of details that other documentaries or books for that matter never captured for me until Once Upon a Time in Queens.
Great.
I wanted to say that the way that you tied in, you know, I know I'm going to transition to the 2021 Mets, but the way you tied in what Rich was talking about regarding New York City in the 70s and the Mets in the 70s with the Warriors and started, like, the way you, like, started to settle into that atmosphere. And also, speaking of something that was very atmospheric and something that really worked for me on a filmmaking level was the Tom Waits song for the credit sequence. That was perfect, especially with off of a 1985 album. If you can talk about setting the atmosphere, how you developed that with a movie like this.
So what happened was I did, if you really want to get in the weeds in the filmmaking, I broke down the story into 18 chapters long before when we were working on the pitch, after that first meeting at ESPN and before we took it out to pitch to the world and before I'd even met with Jimmy Kimmel. I broke it out into 18 chapters and I did it actually. I did visual chapters for myself, and I did little 45-second little clips for each chapter. Like, okay, so this chapter is going to be about this, and I'm going to use this music. And I just had 18 different songs in there, and one of them for one chapter was "Clap Hands" by Tom Waits. And I, it was an album that I loved, Rain Dogs, and I loved the song. And the more I played that song and the clap hands and same were all insane. This sort of implication, the idea that we were all implicated, we knew that this was crazy what we were doing. We knew that this wasn't necessarily the healthiest, best way to behave the way we were behaving in 1986, the way the Mets were behaving in 1986. But that dark spirit just seemed like, ooh, well, that's at a certain point, I played it for a couple of the other people on the production team, and they said, yeah, that could be the one. And the more we went deeper into the production, the more we realized that's a very different kind of feeling from the rest of the movie. The rest of the movie is going to be really fun and poppy and entertaining and ups and downs and highs and lows, and there will be down moments, but it's not going to be that gritty, dark, almost criminal-like energy that you get out of that Tom Waits song. The fact is, I was, in Hollywood in the 90s. I didn't live there, but I had a meeting in Hollywood, and I pitched to somebody. I said, the Goodfellas of baseball. Let's go. Let's do it. We're based on the 86 Mets. We'll do a fictional thing. And the Goodfellas of baseball is sort of how I began to think about it sometimes. And the Waits song seemed right to me for that.
That's great. My 2021 segue question is there anybody on this current team? Let's start with the positive. Is there anybody on this current team you see that has a little bit of that 1986 swagger?
Definitely. That's what's so frustrating about the way they've been playing and the way that they are run, frankly. I think that, I would begin with Baez. I mean, Javi Baez is could have fit in with the 86 Mets. And he's only been here, 6 weeks. And I think that a lot of them have a spark and a spirit and a personality that works in this city or could work. Something is not right. Something is deeply wrong and flawed about this current team. I think Lindor, as awful as he's been, Jeff McNeil, he's Wally Backman in a time machine in a way. I think that he's had I don't know what's going on with McNeil, and I'm sure you guys have discussed, like, did somebody get to him and say, no, don't
you know, don't hit the way you naturally hit. Try this other thing. And I think Lindor has a tremendous spark, and he's proven himself, you know, I mean, that he, you know, in the Yankee game the other night, like, I feel like the stage is not too big for Lindor. You know, Alonso's a big goofball, but he's got tremendous, he's, in a way, he's got a little Gary Carter in him. You know, and yeah. You know, the Mets, you know, Mookie says in the film, like, I was a little worried about how Gary Carter's going to fit in that clubhouse. You know, because he's just not like the rest of them. And I think that that sort of insistent optimism that Alonso has reminds me of Carter a little bit. And I'm sure there are other, DeGrom can be on any team he wants to be on, you know. And Thor, if Thor would come back, you know. I think this is a really good group of players and personalities. I don't think the stage is too big for these guys. I don't know what's gone wrong, and I don't want to just, you know, rag on Rojas. But I think these days you just don't know how much control a manager even has. But the sad and depressing thing about watching this particular group of players is it seems like the manager is not actually watching the game. He's not responding to what is actually happening on the field. And Davey Johnson did. And maybe it's just, there's just too much money involved now, and it's all, you know, this guy's on a pitch count and that guy can't pitch three nights in a row or whatever it is. But there's something really hamstrung about the way this team has been operating this year and the last few years too. And it did seem like, you know, there was a hope among a lot of Mets fans, like, okay, ding dong, the witch is dead. Like, we're not going to be this way anymore once the Wilpons left the running of the franchise. And it's been the same thing where you just feel like, well, wait a minute, is the manager not allowed to make decisions? Or is he just not watching the game? Like, something is wrong.
Something indeed is wrong. And Rich, I'm going to go to you next. It's been 10 days since the last time we were on a podcast. What in your mind, I almost don't remember exactly where we were 10 days ago, but in your mind, you know, the Mets have obviously wasted lots of opportunities. What have you seen gone wrong? What is missing? What 1986 is missing? What do you see wrong?
I agree with a lot of what Nick said. I think they're lacking the fire. And I know that's easy to say, but when you look at Carter, you know, like we saw in the documentary, all he wanted to do was win. Yeah, we hated him when we played against him. Nobody liked the guy. But when he got here, we saw one thing. This guy just wants to win. And I know they all want to win, but it just seems different. It seems like there's something missing. Like, it seems like they lack a killer instinct. Maybe that's what it is. They all want to win. They all try hard. Nobody's questioning that. Nobody's questioning work ethic. Goodness knows we hear enough about the process, right? But there's not a killer instinct on this team. You know, Pete really wants to win, and he, you could see it. He wears it on his sleeve. But there's something, it stops a little, like when they say Seth Lugo's fastball is a little short tonight. There's something a little short about the Mets. There's just something lacking in there, you know? And I like what Nick said about Baez. You know, I was very encouraged when I saw a clip that Baez, I guess, said last night. They asked him, being in New York, he goes, I love it here. He said, we didn't say that exactly. He said, I have family here, and I've always liked New York, and I would come in with the Cubs, and Francisco and I did some great things in the WBC. I'd love to play alongside him. I think, you know, for as much as his agent would let him say, I think he's tipping his hand that he would love to stay. And you need that little – I think Baez is exactly what you need. He brings that swagger. Yeah. He brings that, you know, and the thing that I appreciate the most, when the whole thing happened with Stanton, between Stanton and Lindor, Baez gets in front of Lindor and he's pointing at the Yankees. Like, that's my man. You're not going after a man. Come after me. And
right.
that's the 86 Mets, right? Because Hernandez was saying we were on the top step of the dugout. That's what they need, right, Nick? I mean, they need some more of that. They need another Baez-like personality.
Yeah.
McNeil,
yeah,
please.
McNeil is so fiery, but he doesn't seem to be directing the energy in the right direction. It's like I feel like they could be harnessed by the right kind of manager, and maybe that's just wrong, and maybe it's just sort of, you know, it doesn't happen anymore that a manager can come in and actually set the tone, and it's all the front office. But my hope is that, you know, they clean house and in the front office and get hire a manager and empower a manager, you know, to manage the team. Like, you're the manager, manage it. You know, I know the players have to play and have to execute, but it, you know, the manager really does set the tone. And you know, getting back to the film, like, Davey Johnson was so the perfect manager for that team in 84, 85, 86. It was just, he let them play and watched them play and encouraged them to play, was a very positive guy. But also, you know, would call you out if you weren't doing your job. And that's the other thing. I don't think these players, again, maybe there's just too much money in the game, but these players don't seem to call each other out when they make mistakes. And that 86 Mets team, they would call each other out when they made mistakes. And, I mean, we left so much on the cutting room floor. But, you know, if you were 3-for-4 and happy about it and the Mets lost, they'd punch you in the face. Like, you know, you can be 0-for-4 and miserable, but if we won, you know, I mean, like, it was all about winning. It was all about winning. And I was surprised too. I mean, I talked to them and would say, well, but isn't it always about winning? And they were like, no, I was on a lot of teams where it wasn't really about winning. It was about doing well, trying your best, but you didn't suffer if you lost. And because they'd come so close in 84, 85, and Strawberry used the word suffering to describe 84 and 85. Like, coming up close and losing in 84 and 85, they suffered. They were not going to be denied in 86. So it was all about winning for that 1 year anyway.
Exactly. And that's what I'd like to see them bring in. Now, while I was very encouraged by what I saw from Baez today, I was not encouraged by the quote that Alderson, who will be back, feels as though they need to bring Rojas back to minimize the disruption.
No, I didn't see that. I'm sorry. He says they have to bring Rojas back?
It said that. It wasn't a quote from Alderson. A couple of reporters had it where they said there's a very strong feeling in the Mets organization that Alderson, who will be back, wants to bring Rojas back to minimize the upheaval with the other that are coming. And that was my reaction. It's like, you know what? You know, I don't want to be cliche, but Einstein applies here. You can't bring back the whole team and the manager and expect different results just because of Javi Baez if they're lucky enough to bring him back. You've got to start – there's something missing. You've got to bring in at least a couple of higher-profile players who at least you have reason to believe are the guys we've been talking about, the guys with the fire, the guys who don't accept losing. And, my God, you know, Rojas – I really like the guy, and I hope he stays in the organization. But the difference between Luis Rojas and Davey Johnson in terms of swagger, in terms of confidence, in terms of all those things, it's night and day, and it's not working. You know, a year and a half.
You need someone. I'm sorry. Here's my hope is that there is somebody in the organization who will not tolerate losing, and that person is Steve Cohen. And I think they've been pretty good at not leaking things. I think there's been a lot of stuff leaked and then it doesn't happen. And then all of a sudden they get Lindor, you know? And I think my hope is that you bring in somebody who has been on a winning team in the major leagues, bring in somebody who has won, who knows what it's like to play on a winning team in New York, ideally. I know people don't like Showalter, people don't like Girardi, but those guys, you know, they know New York and they've won. So I was really hoping for either of those guys last time around. Neither of them are great. Neither of them are Davey Johnson. But
I'm not worried by that news. As you just read it, I think, all right, well, sure. What else are they going to say at this point? They're not firing Rojas before the end of the season. And, of course, they're going to say that. But I don't think that we need to take that seriously.
Rich, I want to ask you, before I go to Mike, I want to ask you, was that in the Mike Puma article?
It was. That was one place for it, a couple of other reporters. But, yes, it was in the Puma
article.
I
love Steve Cohen's response on Twitter, which just is like, I'm going to continue to do my thing, and, you know, I'm going to continue to make these sarcastic tweets about, you know, like, you know, guess the source. You'll get a seat in my owner's box forever or whatever. I like the way he deflects in a very, very funny way. Like he and we've talked about how he does feel like he's one of us, like one of us bought the team who happens to have $14 billion. But this is where I want to go with you, Mike, with the 2021 Mets, and specifically with sending Albert Almora up to end the game the other night, and the fact that Rojas was talking about matchups, lefty-righty matchups. He's always talking about lefty-righty matchups, if I have to hear that term one more time. But as many people pointed out, Guillorme has been spectacular against lefties, in fact, better than righties. So when I hear stuff like that, and I also think about how everybody says the manager doesn't manage, I can't see the front office telling them, with all the numbers in front of their face, to send up Albert Almora in that moment. That's where I go, wait, I'm pretty sure this is him managing poorly.
I no longer know what to say. I don't know if you're right. I don't know if front office is calling the shots. I just don't know anymore. I'm as bewildered as you or anyone else. Where we've gone, or look where we've come, you know, in upwards of 35 years. Rich, to your point, you know, bullet points, the players of 86, they had three main bullet points, and I'm not going to repeat them verbatim, but the first one was, we're going to come to your town and drink your beer. The second one, I suggest people just watch and learn. And the third one was, we're going to come to your park and kick your ass. You know, and we heard that from multiple players. You know, and that was across the locker room. They were all in sync. They were all on the same page of music, and they all sung together. And they had a major, major component of accountability, self-accountability, and team accountability. Even though they were wild children, you know, when it came to playing on the field, you know, they took on a different mindset. And Nick, to your point, insofar as Luis Rojas and Davey Johnson, and here I say again, you know, where we've come in 35 years. Yes, Davey Johnson and Frank Cashin knew each other. They were familiar with each other from their days in Baltimore together. But even Davey Johnson told Frank Cashin, you better let me do my job. Don't interfere. And in the press conference, in the documentary, you know, Davey Johnson was cocky about it. He said, you know, Frank Cashin was smart to hire me. And that's just things that will not happen today. You will never catch Luis Rojas or any other manager of the recent past speaking like that. You know, so we've come a long way in 35 years, culturally, socially, you know, and individually for that matter. So there's a lot that separates now from then.
Yes, yes.
It is remarkable, and this is the perfect segue back to 86 in your film. I guess, you know, I literally want to go like bullet point for bullet point everybody you interviewed, just to ask you about everybody. But I guess like who stands out? Let's start with from the interview perspective. Who stands out to you?
Well, it's really they all kind of did. It's like, you know, who's your favorite child? Like I love them each the same in different ways. You know, it's like, I mean, Lenny was one of the most amazing interviews of my life. You know, and yes, he's unhinged and somewhat crazy and slurs his words and you know maybe doesn't seem to be all there. But that guy's a baseball savant.
And he's also really in command of what he's doing. I'm not saying that he's a performer, but he knows the kind of life that he's lived, and he's hilarious and profane, and then also extremely heartbreaking and very open. And by the end of the interview and the end of the documentary, you this guy's like Marlon Brando on the waterfront. He knows he had his moment and it's gone, but he clings to it because of the memories and all of that. Dwight is so open and so honest and so sweet and so gentle and just almost childlike and just, you know, so moving. Daryl Strawberry is beams. He seems to emanate a kind of grace and peace with the world that, like, is incredible. And as a character, you're just like, my God, this guy is amazing. I can't believe how far he's come. He was so troubled and so haunted in the mid-'80s when he played in New York and had so many issues. And, you know, as a filmmaker, my God, what a great character. As a Mets fan, I'm sitting there and he lives in St. Louis. It's so absurdly ironic that Daryl Strawberry has ended up in St. Louis. And as he said, in another cutting room floor thing, he said, you know, God must have a great sense of humor that I would wind up in St. Louis where they hated me and called us pond scum. But I'm sitting across from him. It was an incredible, very long interview day, 8 hours during the height of the pandemic. It's the one flight I took was to fly to St. Louis and interview Daryl Strawberry in person. Just about everybody else we interviewed at a certain point, you know, after March was on Zoom. I was in New York and Lenny was in Los Angeles and Kevin Mitchell was in San Diego. And I was Zooming in with a laptop set up next to the camera. But for Daryl, I'm in St. Louis and spend this incredible day with him. And he's so full of grace and decency. And I thought, man, if he had had his head screwed on like this in the 80s, we would have won more than one championship. And he'd have hit 850 home runs. So he was amazing. And Keith, I mean, Kevin Mitchell, Ray Knight was surprising and so smart and terrific. These guys were all so smart about baseball. That's the other, that was the surprise to me, because they did have such a wild reputation. And as a fan, you just think, well, they show up and they're great. And so they're going to, you know, they're just going to play well. But they were really smart about strategy and who's going to pitch how and, you know, keep your shoulder in. And, you know, Daryl telling that story. And both Daryl and Keith remembered it. You know, Daryl's home run in game 3 of the playoffs against Houston and Keith on second base telling him to keep his shoulder in. And you know, just little things like that. They had such baseball intelligence that was – that was really surprising and kind of amazing to me. So it's a rambling answer to your question, but
it was perfect. And here's where I will ask next, though. Somebody that we all forget in all of this, but somebody that we hadn't heard from much until now, and that was Calvin Schiraldi. That was one of the more fascinating interviews to me. Was how, and I love the first introduction of him is just like, I don't give a rat's ass what anybody thought about me.
Yeah. I mean, he was on the Mets in 84-85 and was going to be the next one. You know, they had this succession of pitchers who were coming up, you know, Darling, then Gooden, and then Fernandez, and, you know, and then Calvin Schiraldi, the next great flamethrower. He's going to be Roger Clemens, you know, you know, and he had been teammates at Texas in college, and you just felt like, wow, it just never ends. And Schiraldi just didn't work out. And he got, you know, tattooed famously in a game in Philadelphia in June of 85, and the Mets thought he was soft, you know. And you know, that is our introduction to Calvin Schiraldi. But how great that Calvin Schiraldi, at whatever age he is, decides, sure, I'll take part in this documentary. Yeah, I know how it ends. It ends with me, you know, spitting a bit in games 6 and 7 of the World Series. But I'm happy to, because he's now a baseball coach and a really successful one for a high school baseball team in Texas. And he's certainly made peace with whatever went on, both on the Mets and then, you know, what happened to him on the Red Sox, where, you know, he came up in 86, in August of 86, and he became their closer down the stretch. He saved 11 games, I think, in August and September,
and was kind of lights out until Game 6 of the World Series.
Exactly. I'm going to go pass it to Rich for the next question.
So, Nick, as I think about it, we saw Greg Prince in the documentary, and Greg has been on our show several times, and he once said something that I want to run by you. One time, I forget what we were talking about, but I said, you know, I'm surprised that this player said that to you, you know, that's in your book. And he said to me, he said, you know, you would be surprised how much these folks will open up to you. He goes, I don't know why. He said, but they don't know me from Adam. You know, I asked for an interview, and then they just start talking about whether it's personal stuff. But you would be surprised at just how open these athletes could be. So my question to you would be, of this that we saw in the documentary, what bit of sharing from a player or anyone you talk to caught you by surprise by their openness? How, wow, I'm surprised somebody would share that. You know, I think about Keith talking about his relationship with his dad. I think about that from the documentary. Yeah. And I think about Daryl, because I knew Daryl came from, you know, a rough upbringing, but I did not realize he suffered the way he did with what his dad used to do. And I saw, you know, like we saw. So what would be an example of you just your jaw dropping when somebody was sharing something with you?
Well, I felt the same way about the Keith stuff. I had no idea how complex and his relationship with his father was, and that he wanted to explain the complexity. You know, it would have been very easy for him to say, yeah, my dad was great, he was my coach, you know, whatever. But I think that the depth of Dwight's trauma as a kid, I wasn't prepared for. I didn't know he was going to be so open about that. You know, when he came along in 84, he was just like a kind of angel, and he behaved, you know, everybody said, like, we all knew Daryl was trouble. He came from a broken home, and it was inner city LA, but Dwight seemed to come from middle-class background, a good, you know, family in Tampa, and his mom and dad were at the games all the time, and it just seemed, and then his, you know, on the field performance in 84 and 85 was just absurd. So, you know, and then when he had the personal problems they came to light in 87 when he failed the drug test, you just thought, oh, poor guy, he couldn't handle it, but at least he's got a supportive family and, you know, he'll be okay. But the stories he tells about, you know, sort of knowing that his father was having an affair and then telling his mother, oh, that's the house where dad goes, and then his mother shoots his father. And, yeah, okay, he lives, but wait a minute. And you're a little kid and your mother shoots your father? How does that affect you? You know, so that I was just not prepared for. And, you know, we begin with Dwight. The first thing we hear from Dwight in the film is that when he was a kid and he loved Little League, but if his parents were at the game, he would not go up to bat. And he says in the film, for some crazy reason, I just couldn't go up to bat. I would just start crying. And he didn't know why, and I'm not a psychiatrist, I don't know why, but probably had something to do with whatever was going on at the home that he doesn't want to perform in front of his parents at that point. And so I feel like Dwight's psychology is so rich and complicated, and I was just not prepared for that. That really caught me by surprise.
Thank you for sharing that, Nick.
Sure.
Thank you, Mike.
Pass guys?
You. Mike, you there? Yep. It does look like we lost Mike, so I will ask you this question. I'm kind of making it macro, but and we got him back. So let me ask you this question before I pass it to Mike. It seemed with trading Kevin Mitchell that Frank Cashin made a old school traditional racist thought. And it's loaded to say, did Frank Cashin kill the dynasty because of racism? but it seems like considering how much everybody talked about Kevin Mitchell being a scapegoat for some reason for Frank Cashin regarding what Daryl and Doc were up to, how much do you think that really did affect the chemistry of the team?
Oh, I think the loss of Mitchell affected the chemistry dramatically. I don't think it can be overstated how important Mitchell was to that clubhouse. I think Mitchell and Knight were two almost irreplaceable characters in terms of the chemical makeup of the team. And, you know, but from a baseball perspective, it's kind of hard to fault bringing in a really dependable all-star caliber outfielder, Kevin McReynolds, who, you know, very nearly wins the MVP in 88. And, I think that, and that one of the reasons I don't like using a narrator is, and there's no narrator in the film, like, I'm leaving it up to the viewers to decide, like, you know, Frank Cashin was right. They were wild and unruly, and it would be better if you guys could contain it a little bit. So how do I solve that? Well, I'm not going to get rid of Strawberry or Gooden, obviously, but, you know, Joe McElvain has wanted Kevin McReynolds for years, and we got a chance to get him. And the only person we have to give up is this guy who plays all over the place but isn't a starter, and actually three other players go to San Diego as well. But let's get him. Let's bring in Kevin McReynolds. So it's, you know, from a baseball perspective, it is kind of defensible. But again and again, I think the story of the 86 Mets sort of underscores the importance of character and personality. And it's why, by the way, I made this film not just for Met fans and not just for baseball fans, but for everybody, because the characters, the movie characters that we're watching, it's Kevin McReynolds, solid ball player, he's not a particularly great character in a movie. I mean, he's the silent type or whatever. You build a different kind of story around him. But the rest of them are just sort of off the charts with charisma.
That they are. I'm going to pass it on to Mike, who I believe we have back.
Yeah, I'm back. And I think that's just more commentary on culture. Matters concerning Kevin Mitchell and George Foster, for that matter, back then, today, yeah, would have set the front pages aflame. If you performed, yeah, things were overlooked.
Right, right. Well, there's that, but the other thing is that, you know, the front pages were set aflame when George Foster, you know, tried to make a comment about race. And he could not have been clearer about saying, I'm not saying it's a racial thing. You know, he began his statement by saying, I'm not saying this is a racial thing, but isn't it interesting? And then he tries to make a very nuanced point about race. But in 1986, merely mentioning the word race was like, it's the third rail. You can't touch it. And the next thing you know, and by the way, he's not hitting, you know, and he's hurting the team chemistry. He never really fit in the clubhouse. And the next thing you know, he's let go. To your point, and Mike, I'm sorry, I'm cutting you off. I think you had a question, but it was a very, very different time.
Oh, without a doubt. I think one of the more ironic moments of 86, if you go back to the ninth, the National League East clincher, Dave Magadan started that game. And in the ninth inning, Keith Hernandez says to Davey Johnson, I want to be out there for the celebration. Fast forward to, yes, Mets versus Boston, and you mentioned Bill Buckner is still out there first base in game,
yes,
six. Again, I find that ironic how that played out. You can't hide players. You know, ultimately the ball's going to find you, and that's what happened to Buckner. Of course, John McNamara should receive any and all the blame for that. You know, anybody who's played baseball, softball, whatnot, and you played first base and you played third base, you know that ball just buried into the ground like that, the first bounce is going to be high. But because of the overspin on that ball, it's going to flatten out. It's not going to bounce like it did the initial time. And that's what happened to Buckner. And he was on two ailing legs, and he just couldn't dig it out. But if you're, you know, familiar with the quirks of first base and third base, you should have known that that ball was going to flatten out. That's just a baseball perspective.
Wow, that's very interesting. I never heard that before. But I really appreciate that you saw that, like, you know, well, why is it okay for Hernandez to go in, you know, because he gets to be on the field for the celebration, but it's not okay for McNamara to decide that Buckner should be on the field for the celebration.
Hernandez was... Well, Keith Hernandez that day was obviously not feeling all that all right, but he still was not in any way, shape, or form defensively compromised the way that Bill Buckner.
Right.
Was. That's my
right.
own point there.
Right. Well, that's true. The other thing that I've always wondered is whether or not that wild celebration where they destroy the turf after the clinching game against the Cubs, whether that played any role at all in either Buckner's error or the way the ball bounced or didn't bounce, and to some extent also Tuffel's error in game one. You know, probably didn't, but it's interesting to think about, well, maybe the field really wasn't in playable shape entirely.
You know, it's so fascinating. Like, I had something as to where we were going to go next. But I guess the next place to go really is Bobby Ojeda, considering that I once sold him pizza after 2014 closing day when Lucas Duda hit his 30th home run. Bobby O, he's just, I think, you know, somebody was telling me today that he's an unsung hero. But for me, I feel like Met fans sing his praises all the time.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny that he didn't come up yet in the conversation. He was absolutely terrific, I thought, in the interview. And it was so good that we did two of them. He actually called after his first interview and said, you know, I feel like there's stuff I left out or I didn't quite express certain things. I was like, well, you can come back, you know, anytime. So we did actually have him back for a second interview. Yeah, I think he was totally instrumental, and he's also a really interesting sort of off-center character, and, you know, just sort of in storytelling points, you know, it's great to have this newcomer who can then tell you about the team from his perspective once you get to part two, and you get to 86 at last, and it's like he's able to come on and say, well, I was in Boston all those years, but I got there, and I was like, whoa. These guys are nuts. Like, these guys are kind of crazy. So, you know, he embraced it. He embraced the craziness. He's a terrific character. And I mean, we also haven't mentioned Mookie. Mookie's a great character and a great storyteller. So you know, it's a great team.
It's spectacular in the way you weave together, and it had to be four parts, the way you weave together everything to show this cohesive story of the 1986 New York Mets and a team. You know, it's a bittersweet story because they could have been more. So we thank you for doing that. And we always like to, before we go to our last word, we always like to send it over to our featured guest for his shameless plug or her shameless plug. Please give to tell everybody where they can find you, past work, as well as you know, where they can find Once Upon a Time in Queens.
Well, I don't know. I mean, well, Once Upon a Time in Queens is on ESPN Digital now, on ESPN Plus, and on demand. I think it's also being rerun on the main network or ESPN 2 anyway. And I guess I would also, you know, plug, I happen to have a book out. There's also going to be a companion book to the series, also called Once Upon a Time in Queens, which is essentially an oral history. And so it contains a lot of stories that we just didn't have time for in the series. And some really great ones actually from Ray Knight and well, all of them really. So that book is coming out. And then I also
have a book that I wrote over the last 18 years about my grandfather and great uncle. And that book just hit bookstores 2 days ago, the same day the film aired on ESPN. My grandfather was Herman Mankiewicz, who wrote Citizen Kane and was the subject of the movie Mank. So people may know that. And I have written a book about him and his brother, Joe Mankiewicz, who wrote and directed All About Eve. And the book is called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, a dual portrait. And it takes its title from this famous telegram that Herman, he was one of the first, actually really was kind of the first New York writer who was lured out to Hollywood. And he sent a telegram back east when he first got there in the late 20s to his friend Ben Hecht that, you know, it said, you know, will you accept $300 per week to come work for Paramount? All expenses paid. The $300 is peanuts. There's millions to be grabbed out here, and your only competition is idiots. Don't let this get around. And that started the flood of Eastern screenwriters out to Hollywood. And so I've written a book that is a sort of dual portrait of the two of them. So yeah, if you're going to ask for a shameless plug, I'm going to give you one.
Yes, that's great. And that's, you know, I was a big fan of the movie Mank, but a big fan of Citizen Kane and your grandfather's work. So that's pretty outstanding to hear, and I look forward to reading your work as well. So, again, thank you for joining us tonight. And I'm going to pass it around for final words as well as anything else. Let's start with Rich Spirago.
So, Nick, just from me, again, thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you for the documentary and the way you tell the story. I lived through it. Like I said, I was fortunate enough to be at the home games of the 86 postseason, but I've learned so much. So not only am I reliving a great memory, but I'm also learning in the process. And as someone who has a daughter in her 20s, and I think she and her friends are of the belief that the Mets never actually did win anything, I think I'm telling revisionist history when I say they actually did win the World Series. I'm going to make them watch it with me so they can see that it's true. So thank you, Nick.
Good. Well, thank you. That's great to hear. And I really do. I'm very optimistic about the Steve Cohen era. I really am.
Same for me. And I'm going to pass it on to Mike.
Well, Nick, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you. Again, a lifelong Mets fan who was there during the dark years, who has this uncommon experience of being overseas when they win the World Series, and I'm still waiting for my first World Series in person. I want to thank you again for bringing me as close to that 86 team as I've been without being here. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. What a wonderful piece. Great, great work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate thank you again, Nick, and thank you all out there for listening to the Metsian Podcast, and make sure to subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts, and please make sure you go see Nick Davis's work, Once Upon a Time in Queens, on ESPN's 30 for 30. Check it out. I'm sure a lot of you have access, so go watch it right now, right after you listen to us. So once again, thank you. Thank you all out there. And the only way to end this, as always, is let's go Mets. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Take care, Nick. Thank you. Later, Mike.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks so much.
Good night. Let's go Mets.